Hello, sir.
Hello, how are you,
Good, mate. I don't know what happened last time, but that's good. So I'm on video, but I don't know if you just want to be in audio, that's cool. Mate, excellent album. Really, really good. Yeah, you must be very pleased with it.
Switch to my other speakers. That's better. That's better. Yeah, you never, I mean, you can never second guess anything. So, when it comes to recording and stuff, you kind of got to go with your instinct. And, it's weird because I always read in the past when people go, we don't care what people think. We make the album so that we're happy. And it's like, right. But then inevitably, you're probably going to fail. Whereas if you just make some music that connects with you hope at some point it's going to connect with somebody else. If it's real, if it means something, if there's an intention, then someone somewhere, it could be one person, it could be a million people, but someone might connect with it. I think that's the goal. So that's kind of what we did. We went naturally with it. Jeff said, how do we put this? And I said, we just write and play. That's who we are. We just be who we are. Like it, they won't like it, as long as we're happy, we've challenged ourselves and we've been honest to ourselves, and this is what it is, because this is how we do it. That's as much as we can do. The rest is left to fate, I guess. Yeah. So.
And Jeff's these solos, pretty good.
People have said, how do you compare it to Alvia? But one of the beautiful things I always loved about Venom in the early days, in particular, lots of bands, but Venom in particular is, it's always Venom, but the production was always very different from piece to piece. You couldn't take any one of the singles or any one of the albums and nothing was replicated. The production was different. The kind of songwriting was different. The performance was still those individuals. You always get the same people. Metallica is Metallica, whether they're making Saint Anger or they're making Master of Puppets. Just you might prefer one against another, but there was a variation. So each piece, like the Bloodlust single or Manitou or Warhead or Primeval, Welcome to Hell, Possessed, it's a moment in time, because at that moment you're 20 and you have all those angst of a 20-year-old, and you have all that stuff going around in your life and the economy, politics and world events, and that all feeds into who you are at that moment, so it becomes that moment. But 20 years later, you're not 20 anymore, you're 40, and you have different things, and that feeds in. So each piece should be a moment. So to kind of try and recreate the younger you each step of the way, I think will fail anyway. So yeah, and so I think Jeff felt a new lease of life on this. Between albums, he died and come back. We had all kinds of stuff go on, the pandemic, and I think that all fed into this rush to just express ourselves. So there was like no boundaries. We just went, it doesn't have to sound like anything else, it just has to sound like whatever it is. So we had that freedom. So his expression on there, I loved so much.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, lyrically, I wouldn't say it's necessarily bleak, but I mean, you don't pull any punches. So I was going to ask, like, with the title track, is it kind of like Jeff's experience, or just a, how you feel?
Yeah, no, it really is. I mean, there's a kind of, when we first put the album cover out with the album title, and I did just put it together and then put it out, a lot of reactions immediately was, what the fuck is that? What is that? What? And people didn't get it. And then as people kept seeing the image and then kind of listening to what we were saying, they were going, wow, that's dark, wow, that's heavy. And it's like, yeah, kind of, it's a questioning thing. I mean, the album, I based the album over two albums. We wrote 24 songs in total just because we could. In the pandemic, we didn't have any pressure from getting everything done and getting on tour and trying to fit in gaps. So we took our time. We wrote 24 tracks. I decided they should go over two albums, so it would be part one, part two. And based it on Dante's Inferno, the Nine Circles of Hell, just your journey, an average human's journey from birth to death and all the crap that we get in between, and the journey you were on. And so that was where it was, and I was even doing the artwork for that. And then we were exchanging our songs back and forth, and Jeff dropped one on me and said, oh, there's a song if you want to have a listen to. So, okay. And then he said, yeah, I've kind of put lyrics to it and everything, and it's kind of about my death experience, because, like, when I went, I didn't see anything, really. I just saw this void, and I just felt an overwhelming sense of black, so I call it There's Only Black. And the moment he said that, it kind of, everything snapped into shape for me. I just went, right, it's called There's Only Black. I've got an idea, this is what we're doing, this is the album cover, and that was how it grew. So, yeah, it was his experience of what he felt he saw or didn't see. But I think it then, for me, it took the meaning beyond even that. You know, the questionable thing, what's at the end of the universe? What's for supper tomorrow? Where are we going? What happens if we're going to get to the top of that mountain? What's in a black hole? What happens after life? You know, some of the questions we can answer. You can get to the top of Everest. What's it like at Everest? You can go to the top and you can tell people. What's that going to happen tomorrow? You can do the event and then tell people. What does this taste like? You can taste it and then tell people. But going into a black hole or going into death, you have to commit. And it's only for the individual to commit. And once you've committed, you discover what it is, but you can't come back and tell me. And that's what I found is the most intriguing thing. It's about the singularity of your experience in such events. So I guess in a way, you know, after death could be perfect, it could be nothing, we just don't know. In the black hole, nothing comes out, so it crushes everything inside. But what if you went in there and it wasn't? What if it was Copacabana Beach and it was coconuts and free drinks for the rest of your life and your favorite food? You wouldn't be able to tell anybody, but you would experience it yourself. So I guess by putting the black hole, the vortex, the energy ball on the front of the album, I took the logo off and I put the font that I used is from a cemetery, a gravestone in Highgate Cemetery in London, where I was going through and had a look, and it just, that spoke to me too. So it became a thing, it's about life. It's, is it bleak or is it not? But if you come into the album, if you go into the black hole, maybe you'll discover something. Maybe you'll discover something someone else might not. You might come out with your wellies on and go, it's a bit muddy, and then someone else comes out with their swimming trunks on and goes, it was bliss. So that's the idea.
Well, yeah, and I guess the lyrics on stuff like Man is God and Don't Feed Me Your Lies, it also is fairly, you know, direct, but at the same time, yes, it's probably more philosophical than you might expect from black metal.
Well, yeah, you know, even when I discussed with the label about the first approach, which I maintained the approach to the album, it was just the album title, but the theme stayed the same, because I liked that theme dealing with, you know, when you're looking for the dark things in life and the hope and the light, you know, it is us. We emanate that. We create that. You know, we create everything that we then worry about or we're happy with. So, you know, it's about choice, it's about creation, and I think that's it. I think it's kind of philosophical. I mean, the first version of the album cover, when I sent through, the label went to, oh yeah, that's kind of cool, so it's this, and I was like, yeah. So I started to explain it, and they went, don't you think that's a bit too cerebral for everybody? And I was like, no. And they went, really? And I was like, oh, maybe we should have a dragon eating a horse, eating a Jesus, eating a cross, you know, burning in hell. Yeah, that's obvious. But I just think that if it stimulates and evokes a personal participation in that. So it makes you question. Even if fans come up to me, so I was at UK Death Fest last week, seeing all my friends, Autopsy and Tom Warrior, you know, doing his Hellhammer tribute, and a young fan came up and was like, "Oh yeah, yeah," and so excited, and said, "Oh, I love the cover," and I said, "What is it?" And they went, "The cover. Do you not know what it is?" I said, "I know what it is, but what is it to you?" And they went, "Is it like an eyeball?" I said, "Is that what you see?" They went, "Kind of like an eyeball." I said, "And what are you looking into?" They went, "Just the blackness inside." I said, "Which is?" And they went, "I don't know, whoever the person is." I said, "Right, so that's cool. You know, you're already asking questions. Are you looking into someone else's eyeball, looking for something?" You know, so... I think that's the coolness about it. You know, make the participant in this case, you know, search for stuff. And you know, there's the music. If you just want to hear the music and you want to be bludgeoned by something like that, then okay. But if you want to see more, you can. On more listens, you'll hear more. On reading and understanding the lyrics, you'll see more. And on just by staring at the cover, you might. Because I always loved it when I grew up. You know, you would go into a record store, I'd buy albums just because the cover looked cool, and then I couldn't hear them in the store. I couldn't stream them. I had to wait till I got home to put them on. Sometimes you were disappointed. Sometimes it was amazing. But the album cover usually evoked something in me that made me want to have it. So that's kind of what I was trying to get back in an old school way, to something that would evoke you to think, that's interesting. I wonder what is happening there. So.
Yeah, fair enough. The music itself is not just bludgeoning. I mean, if you've got songs like Burn Liar Burn, where it's almost like instrumental partially, and even with Don't Feed Me Your Lies, the clarity of the production, the bass, you can hear it. How did you go about the instrumentation this time?
Well, that was a big thing. I mean, in our compositions, where, you know, they felt very real, very live, much like we are in a live situation. And Jeff wanted to express himself on the guitar, so he had the freedom to just create, you know. And I just said, let's not have any rules. It was the same thing with Jeremy when he put the drums down. He went, you know, how do you want me to approach this? And I said, I want you to feel it. You know, music's about feeling. If you feel it should happen, play it. You know, if it doesn't feel right, don't play it. But I don't want to, once you start trying to shape a particular instrumentation or an artist, you might lose the them in there, their actual character. But with production wise, Jeff wanted to peel back. He was like, I want to make it a bit less, more distortion. He doesn't use so much distortion on the guitar. When people used to go, how do you get that sound? Yeah, actually very simple. You know, he has a distortion, a chorus for soloing on top of that, and he uses a straight Marshall usually, so which is overdriven, and that's it. So wow. How he gets the sound, it's his identity, how he plays. But we wanted to get the bass was rolled back a bit with the growl on it. The guitar was almost clean in a way, so that we could have that clarity of instrumentation, because we wanted people to hear everything that was being played, even at speed, rather than, you know, just a mush of rah, which is cool. I like that myself. But we just wanted to be able to hear three people, but also not just hear them individually coming together, supporting each other in the music, but also feel like you were there when they were playing it. So have it almost live, if you like, so that you feel it's real. It's not overproduced. It's not polished within an inch of its life and affected. It's just as it is. It's almost like a plug-and-play album. We plugged in, we sat down, we started playing it, and you sat there with us until we finished, and that was the idea.
So with arrangements, does it take a lot of back and forth and, you know, post-production and all that kind of stuff?
Well, generally, normally we would be in a situation where I would go to Portugal and spend some time with Jeff, and we'd put ideas together, what we had, and look at the shapes and rearrange and, if we needed to. But sometimes we'd have completed songs. This time, because of pandemic, we had to work on three different countries, so Mantis was in Portugal, I was locked in London, Kling was in Tampa in Florida. So we did a lot of this kind of thing, like Zooming and FaceTiming and sharing files. What do you think of this? What do you think of that? But basically, each composition, with sent me something that he just had completed as a demo, and I would do exactly the same for him, and we'd send them to Jeremy. He would record the drums, whatever he felt. We'd get them back, we'd do our bits, and we just progressed in that way. So it was always that natural person contributing to that song, which ended with the result. So a few arrangement things we discussed, or ideas, and some we just let go, let the other person just go with their idea, and then we'd all listen and go, yeah, that works, that's great. So cool. It was kind of exciting from that.
That makes sense. The last two tracks on the album, like Dance Macabre and Inferno, they've got a lot of different rhythm figures in there, and you know, I guess how much rehearsal is needed to get that really tight?
None. We do no rehearsal. Huh. I mean, basically, our rehearsals, you know, what we've learned over the years, and particularly with the invention of this kind of thing with digital media and file sharing, is we're fortunate to have access to our own kind of studios. Mm-hmm. But it means that we can... you know, I can go away, because one of my things all the time was, if you had a song that's 40 years old, how can you go on stage and not know that song or make mistakes in that song?
Yep.
And I was like, I don't understand that. So what it means is you wrote a song 40 years ago, you played it then, and you never played it again. And I was like, well, you know, surely it's there at your fingertips. So we've kind of perfected a way, because of our distance, a living distance connection, that we will put our set together, put the tunes we want to do together, we'll rehearse them consistently over the week as individuals, and then we come together at wherever the show is. Once we hit the 1, 2, 3, 4, we all play our parts. We're all playing the same song in the same timing, if we've learned our parts properly, so it should work. And so that's kind of our rehearsals. As soon as we go live, we're rehearsing. So we'll do a pre-rehearsal, kind of like a demo by ourselves. Any questions we'll ask each other, so we'll know where we are. And then as soon as we go live, we're ready. We're just absolutely ready. We're all ready to play it. So it's knowing your material, I guess.
Yep.
It's quite easy to do an album, spend all the time doing an album, and then put it on the shelf, and it goes out, and you do all the follow-up for it, and then you go on tour, and you've got to go, which songs are we doing? I have to relearn those songs.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, it's a refresher, but I think the more in tune you are with your material, the less you kind of have to rehearse. It's just remembering certain items on there. So, but yeah, logistically, we kind of rehearse ourselves as individuals, and then we go into game mode, and that's when it all starts to happen.
Okay.
And we like to try and be on point from day one. We don't throw any shows away, so we don't go, well, we're in Kansas City, so it's all right if it's shit tonight, because we're just having the first run through. But yeah, by the time we get to New York, it'll be brilliant. It's like, no, we need to be on point from day one, so we really work hard on that, you know.
Yeah, and I'm sure that would be a fatal mistake for many bands to think that way.
Yeah.
How would you say your vocal delivery has changed over the years? I mean, you've still got that Lemmy type snarl.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's just age and youth, really. You know, I'm just an old fuck now, and I was a young fuck then. So, you know, I guess my, again, like a lot, maybe a lot of people, you know, I didn't go in to be a singer. It was a fait accompli. I ended up singing. So, you know, after, I think it was probably maybe, you know, 10 years, I realized that I would have certain issues, mic position, or if there was dry ice, or you know, holding my breath for the right notes. And I just thought, why, you know, I have to work on this. And so, you know, shouting around in the house is not how to do it. You have to do it properly. So I went to see an opera coach, friend. She was brilliant, and she gave me all this stuff to do, and a tape, so I would go through my scaling. She told me what my range was, and how to work around that. If I couldn't stretch the vocal cords, this is how you work around the range. If I had problems, this is how you control it. And it was just amazing. And so I started to apply that. And I just think, years of smoking and drinking whiskey and stuff like that, which is my only voice is really when I'm on tour. And I just think as you age, you know, my voice was getting sicker and dropping, and you know, of course, using your vocals in that way kind of shapes your vocal cords too. So I think it's just a natural progression. Mm. So normally I just feel the music and I go, and if it comes out this way, it comes out this way, and if it comes out that way, it comes out that way. So I guess it's not contrived; it's a very natural thing. But being able to apply the techniques, it means I'm always full of breath, because we would play live shows, and at the end of Don't Burn the Witch in particular, and it is all the way up to the end, and then we go straight into the next song. And I don't know how many times I nearly blacked out trying to hold that for like, you know, 25 seconds all the way up. And if you didn't take enough breath, but still had to hold the note, and I'd see stars and thinking, oh my God, I'm going to faint, you know, while you're doing it. So I thought that's where the breathing comes in and the control comes in. So it's about being confident on stage. It's like playing your instrument. I always rehearse to a mirror. So I do all my rehearsals to a mirror. So I'm so used to seeing, I can see where my notes are, but it means when I go on stage, I don't have to keep looking down at my hand every 5 minutes to think, there it is, there it is, there it is, there it is. You know, I can make references when I'm doing chord changes, but generally I know in my head when I'm on stage performing, I can see my hand in the mirror on the neck, so I know how long the neck is. I'm familiar with it, so it's kind of like feeling it. It's the same thing with the vocal. It just becomes natural. You know where you can go, when you can go, and how far you can go, so you stay within your limits and only push when you really have to, if you can't hear or whatever. Yeah,
and I'm sure people like you know, Tom Araya from Slayers had to think about that with his screams in Angel of Death.
absolutely, you know. And you know, you just think, and then you talk to Tom, and you know, I even remember seeing them on that tour when that just came out, and he, you know, he'd done his stuff on, you know, before his High Notes, but you know, on Hello 8 and stuff, but that note, that thing, and I just thought, I don't know, and you talk to him, and he's just like talking like this, and then he just takes in, and that thing comes out of nowhere. I'm like, where is that coming from? It's yeah. Like he had it in a separate bag carrying it with him. You know, it blows my mind. I wish I could hit those notes. I can't, but it would be nice to.
Well, I guess the similarity, though, is that you both, you know, got clear vocals compared to, you know, your black metal scene and death metal, where there's that, you know, tendency for all the growls and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, not all of it, but there's so much of it I absolutely love. But I do get lost sometimes. One of the things Jeff always complained about, why he doesn't like that whole kind of style, is he can't sing along. And it's like, well, yes, it's not rock and roll all night, is it? Or Hellbent for Leather, so, you know, or Breaking the Law. So, you know, it's not something you can participate in. You can lose your mind, and I understand that coming from the back punk background. You know, when I would go and say the Upstarts or the UK Subs or something like that, you know, yeah, as long as I heard the chorus, which was usually one word, I was just in there, you know, kicking crap out of everything and getting kicked the crap out of. So it was about that, just get that energy out, you know, so that's great, I get that. And I see the kids doing that. But I like could hear, there's a couple of bands I went to see, and I other than the title of the song, I was like, and there's sometimes the title sounds amazing. It sounds like, yeah, fuck the system and blah, blah, blah. And then I don't know what they've said throughout the whole thing. And I said, well, if you're going to do a protest song, are you going to do an anti-this or an anti-that song? Or you're surely everybody's supposed to know what you're saying. Hmm. Otherwise, what's the point? It's just a title. But maybe that is the point. I don't know, you know. But, yeah, I think I've always just wanted to get the lyrics are important for me. You know, so not only the... And rather than have a title that says, you know, fuck the system, and then the lyrics are nothing to do with that, I'd rather have a title that doesn't say fuck the system, but the lyrics say fuck the system, you know what I mean? So I'd kind of like to play with that, you know, have something a bit more benign as a title, but then a bit more expressive as a lyric, so you want to discover what does that mean. I wrote a song once called Foliage, because I was looking for a title of a song that I had with Amcraft, and I looked on the back of the newspaper, and it was the sports section. I thought, oh, just looking for a word, and it was about a golf match that had just happened, and the he lost his ball in the foliage, and that foliage came out. So I went, ah, that's the name of the song, and I thought, oh yeah, cool. So I wrote all this about the underlife against the norm, you know, so normal life, and then, but what's actually really happening? And we did a show with girls' school. I remember girls' school going to me, what the fuck does foliage mean? I said, well, and they went, yeah, I know what it means, but like, what do you think it means? And I was like, well, this is the meaning. They went, I don't get any of that. And I realised, oh, okay, so maybe it's just my warped mind as well.
That's yeah, still pretty funny, though.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Just quickly, if you look back at, like, Primeval lineup, and, you know, not getting into the politics of other Venom and all the rest of it, but, do you think, now that there was the band reformed and all so on, did you expect that this would keep going?
No, in fact, quite the opposite. You know, when we were about to record the third Empire of Evil album, Unleashed, we had the recordings done, we just had all the drums committed, and so that was our intention. When we got Keep It True, Oliver said, would you come and play Keep It True in Germany? And he said, if Abaddon was around, could he jump up and do a couple of songs with you? And I was like, oh, there's no way that's going to happen, because Jeff would just say, fuck that, you know? And he was like, yeah, but you could make it happen. I said, yeah, but no, I think it's too big of an ask. I don't know if I could. And he said, listen, there's one man on earth that could make it happen, it's you. So why don't you do that? Just five songs. So I went to them and managed to make it happen. And it kicked off from there. I had a shirt done specifically for there. We called it Venom Incorporated Iron and Steel. The T-shirts turned up, said Venom Inc. And I was like, it's supposed to say Incorporated. And they were like, well, yeah, but on the shirt it looks shit. So we just did Venom Inc. Iron and Steel was still there, the old logo. And then that changed. It just changed. Nobody would call us Iron and Steel. They just kept calling us Venom or Venom Inc. And then right after that show, we started to get offers to do more shows. So I said, well, okay, if people want to see us. So I asked the two guys, I said, what do you want to do? Maybe we could do, like, you know, 12, 15 months, just play live shows, nothing more, and just, you know, go and see the fans and play music we like. They both agreed, and that was the intention. Eventually, after about, you know, 12, 13 months, I got John Cezulla back on board and Chuck Billy, because I just said, look, I need help, because this is becoming bigger. We're going all over the planet, and people are, I can't manage the whole thing, and merchandise in several different territories.
Yeah.
I need some help with the management thing. So they eventually came back on board, and then they said, you've got to do an album. And I was like, no, because that will be the death of a band. Once you do albums, everybody argues about publishing and writing and money. And then you've got to sell it to a label. So you're going cap in hand to go, do you like us? Can we make? And I said, but at the minute, we just go out, do our thing, play our shows, and it's much more fun. But they convinced us. We did three tracks, me and Jeff. Send them to, they said, well, who do you want to send them to? Make a list. I only had one name on. I said, Nuclear Blast. We send it to Nuclear Blast. If they say yes, it's a go. If they say no, we're not making any albums. We just keep doing what we're doing. And okay. Unfortunately or fortunately, they said, yeah, great, make an album. I was like, oh, bollocks, here we go. So it became very real very quick. And so it wasn't contrived again, not combating Kronos' Venom, that it was out and he was doing his thing. It wasn't supposed to be the yin to a yang. It wasn't supposed to be anything. From my point of view, it was like, well, if you can't see the three original members together, you should be able to see them however they are. And this way, you can see these two guys, and then when he goes out, you can see him. And if they all play black metal, that's those three people. Okay, they're not doing it at the same time in the same place, but they're all playing that classic track. And what about the stuff that nobody heard? What about Dead of the Night, Woman, Women, Leather and Hell, Cry Wolf? What are all those tracks they never played? So we can, if he doesn't want to do that because he's promoting his new music, we can do that. Hence incorporate it. Just incorporate anything we want to play across the Venom spectrum at any point. So that was the intention, you know. And that's still the intention.
No, understood. Look, I'm pretty much running out of time, but any chance of rescheduled dates to Australia?
Yes, actually, funny enough, I talked to Doug at Hardline Media 2 weeks ago, and we're rescheduling. I went to see Exciter because we're coming with Exciter, and we're looking March, April, as soon as we can, really. But I think he said maybe March, April is going to be the best way to come down. I'd like it to be sooner than that, but I think because we were delayed so many times with the pandemic and all that, of course, Exciter got bookings and we got bookings, so we're like, we got to look for the first window we've got. So it will be early in 2023, and I'm really sorry it's 2023. I want it to be as soon as possible, but it looks like it's going to be as early as we can after Christmas.
That's cool. And just a final question very quickly. How'd you get into Boel Guitars? I'm not sure how you say it.
Boel, yeah. Well, funny enough, there's an incredible luthier who worked for them, and a journalist friend of mine who does Arrow Lords of Metal, which is, he's the editor now, which is the biggest online metal mag thing in Holland. Mm-hmm. He was coming to a show, and he brought this guy, he said, I'm bringing a plus one. I was like, yeah, okay, we were playing this show, and for Mario Van Dorn, a mini festival. And this guy turned up with a bass case, and they came and he said, oh yeah, this is my friend Al Cole. And I was like, yeah, you're all right. And he was like, yeah, can I show you this? And I was like, if you want, yeah. And he opened it, and there was this big purple bass called the Big Generator by Boel. And so I picked it up, and it was fucking beautiful. It was like the chocolate of basses. I was like, wow. And I played jazz basses. My basses are all with jazz, so they're kind of different. And this was a jazz, and I was like, oh my God, yeah. And he said, you can use it tonight if you want to try it out. And I went, mate, they don't call me the demolition man because I don't break stuff. I can't bring that on stage. I said, fucking hell. I said, how much is that worth? He went, I know, about 4,000. I said, put it back in the box and take it away. I said, because like I'll break it. I can't afford to break it. Anyway, he convinced me, well, just use it for a song, see what you think. And I was like, okay, well, if you insist. So, and it had one of the pots, it had like a humbucker boost. So if you pulled the pot up, it boosted the signal.
Yep.
And I had an Ampeg, a 700 watt Ampeg amp, which I'd been running all the way through. Everything was good. So I come to do one song, he brings his bass on. I go, right, okay, I just turn the amp, I pull the bass pot, I hit the E string and the fucking amp blew up. So I took it straight off, I gave him it back, and I went, give me the bass, switched amp. So I took my old bass, switched over. When I came off after the show, he said, did you not like it? I went, no, I'll buy it off you. He's like, oh, you like it? I went, yeah, it just blew that amp up. I said, fucking hell, 700 watts, this thing blew that amp up, it's perfect. So that was it. And so they operate out of Holland, and they supplied me three. I have three now, and I think now they're changing company or whatever, changing ownership or something. So they're backing off. But yeah, I have three, and they're like, they just become part of my identity. For years, I was looking, you know, because I always had Rickenbacker and I had an Overwater, but these have just become part of my identity, and they're so wonderful to play. Everything that I would want from an instrument, particularly from a jazz bit, these have got, you know. So yeah, they're perfect.
Nice. Well, look, thanks very much for having a chat to us. I'll let you go.
All right, bless you. All right, have a good day, okay. And thank you so much.
See ya.
Ciao.
Bye.
Thank you.